Hi, and welcome to the How Not to Think podcast, the podcast that gets you thinking about your thinking and challenges things like conventional wisdom, stereotypes, and even looks at things like binary thinking. I'm Dr. Howard Rankin, and today I'm delighted to have with me, all the way from New York, Deborah Heiser, Dr. Deborah Heiser, an applied developmental psychologist, TEDx speaker, consultant, adjunct professor at the State University of New York, founder of the Mentor Project, which I'm really excited to find out more about. Her research is extensive, looked at depression, and we'll also get into the interesting topic of aging, which Deborah's done a lot of work on too. Okay, enough from me. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Howard. I love your podcast, and it's a privilege to be here with you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Honor to have you with us. Tell us, you know, typically like to get the audience know a little bit about your trajectory, about how you get to be where you are today.
Sure. It's been a process, which I happen to think that the biggest joy in life is going through the process of, you know, the journey of whatever it is that you're trying to achieve. I started out deciding to go into the field of psychology because my grandmother was depressed in an assisted living home in Florida. And she was one of the most vibrant individuals one would ever meet. And I went down there, and there was a psychologist, and I didn't even really know what a psychologist was at the time, to be quite honest. Mm-hmm. I was young, and I said, "There's something wrong with grandma." And she said, "We're going to fix her." And I thought, "What?" And they did. She, they treated her for depression. She got better. And when I saw that happen, I thought, wow, this is a big deal. I want to do this. Mm-hmm. So that was how I got started. And since then, it's just been a process of really getting excited about the possibilities that exist for us as we grow older, that it's opportunities rather than challenges. And that anytime there is something that is an outlier that comes up, we have a way to fix it, just like the psychologist did for my grandmother. And so that's how I got started. That led to being a researcher for quite a while in a nursing home in Northern Manhattan, and doing a lot of research on depression and frailty and all of that. And all of the things that most people think are a part of aging, right? And it wasn't until someone at a dinner party said to me, "Well, what do we have to look forward to? Why do you study aging? Everything is so down and it's a real drag." And I said, "But we're helping to find out how to solve these problems that we come across." And the person said, "That doesn't make me want to look forward to aging." Mm. And I thought, wow, you're right. All we can do is put a Band-Aid on bad things that are going to happen to us. So it was like an epiphany for me, where I went and said, "Uh-oh, what is it that I really want to do with the field of aging? What, you know, I'm aging. I want to look forward to things. I don't want to look forward to a vitamin D pill, you know, to help me not become frail or to mitigate frailness." So I really started to look at the work of Dan McAdams, whose work was really in line with Eric Erickson's developmental trajectory, which is emotional. So while what I was able to learn was that while we all focus on our physical trajectory, which is a very steep incline, when we're young, we're learning to walk, talk, run, do all of these things, we get expert in it. And then there's a decline that happens. The peak is pretty early, and then there's a decline. And that's what scares all of us. That's what makes us afraid of aging. What no one really focuses on is our emotional trajectory. And that starts at zero, just like when we're babies and getting ready to learn to walk and talk and do all of our physical things. But this one never goes down. It always continues to go up. So even though, you know, say I'm in my mid 50s, I can expect to be happier than a kid in their 20s. That's what we know in aging. Mm-hmm. And so getting involved in that and in looking at that and researching that and really focusing my work on what do we have to look forward to, really has been such an enormous pleasure, because I'm able to really show people that we don't have to look at life as a series of challenges, but rather a series of opportunities, because we have amazing things to look forward to. I can tell you that there's no one who I've ever worked with who's said, boy, you know, I'm in my 70s. I wish I could run as fast as I did when I was 15. People don't generally care if they can run as fast or do as many push-ups or do those sorts of things, but they do care that they feel fulfilled, that they feel like they have purpose, that their life had meaning. Those are deep and those are really personal. So that's where it's really exciting. And that's what led me to found the Mentor Project, was looking at that.
Excellent. Yeah, excellent. And yes, there's so many misconceptions about aging. It's unfortunate. And anyone who can help change those is doing a great job. You know, one thing's the word retirement. Why would you define a period in life, which has actually got a lot of richness to it, by something you're not doing, going to a regular job? That doesn't make sense to me. And you're absolutely right. Of course, it is about meaning and purpose and some extent self-transcendence. You will, of course, know about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Something I actually discovered fairly recently was just before he died, Maslow added another level to that hierarchy, which was beyond self-actualization, which is often taught, to self-transcendence, which in some ways is a wonderful next level up. And I think those are that's the sort of magical, wonderful things that can happen, and perhaps only can happen as you age. So there's lots of great things that can happen as you age. Not all this sort of disappointment and I can't do what I used to do and all of this. And a lot of misconceptions. The memory loss is actually functional. I mean, if you have a computer and you have an app that cleans up the computer to get rid of stuff that you don't use, yeah, that's what your brain is doing for memories you haven't used for 20, 30, 40 years. They're a waste of space. Let's get rid of them. And then if you try to access them, you say, oh, I can't forget them. I'm getting old. No, part of getting old is revising your system to be as functional as possible. So there are many, many aspects of aging that need to be rethought, like the way you have done. And one question I had as you were telling the story, how old were you when you watched them transform or treat your grandmother?
I was in my late teens. So okay. I would say about 19 or so.
All right. Yeah, I'm just thinking, and that makes sense. That would be about the time you would be thinking about career or college mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Yeah, no, that's great and wonderful personal experience. What did your research on aging, and I'm sure there's many aspects of it, what did it, apart from some of these things we're talking about, what did you find?
You know, the research that we were doing on depression and frailty, most of those, what I learned really well, and my dissertation won an international award because I was looking at depression a little bit differently. What we know is that when I went into the nursing home, I was going in it was a practicum. I was just going in there as part of my graduate program to learn a bit and be helpful and to get a lay of the land, so to speak. And I was going in every day and I looked around and they said, wow, we have such a low incidence of depression here. And I thought, well, I mean, it was a great facility. I thought, wow, this is great. Of course it is. And I said, I don't think so, but I'm not the expert. So I must not know what I'm looking at. I must be wrong. And then I kept coming back and I said, maybe I'm not wrong, you know, because I would see individuals who looked depressed. Mm-hmm. And I had been working at Cornell Medical Center in Westchester prior to that in a psychiatric hospital with research focused on depression. So I knew what depression looked like, but everyone kept telling me that the people there were not depressed. So I thought, all right, I'm young. I don't know what I'm talking. I need to talk to the experts. And then I finally said, no, I'm going to actually do my dissertation on this. I'm going to look at this and see if, in fact, the way that they're measuring depression is actually capturing it. And it turns out that they were using a federally mandated measure that only asked really two questions about whether or not the person was depressed, which was, you know, is Mary crying? Well, not every depressed person cries. They were asking things that a nurse would go in and be able to put in their, they had mm-hmm. to do a very long, tedious set of requirements on the health of each individual. And so these two questions were there. And so they'd yell out, hey, has Mary been crying lately? No, okay, great. And so I went out and I looked at all more than 700 residents. And we found that there was a 44% incidence of missed individuals. Not everyone was depressed, but some were suffering from adjustment disorder or other things. And so one thing that I learned is that we need to look at the emotions, not just the physical output of what a person mm-hmm. is expressing, because that, as we all know, I could be thinking and feeling things that you're not able to tell because it's on the inside. Right. So we need to look at the emotions. So very quick and easy 15 item questionnaire that took very little amount of time was able to show a lot of people who had depression, and then they can get treated.
Right.
You know, that's the good thing, is that mm-hmm. then people can get treated. So yeah. That's what I found. And that gave me hope that I said, wow, if we can keep doing this kind of work, then we can make change all across the country and we can have a lot of healthy grandmas.
Yeah, that's good. Yes, and of course those measures in research sometimes are pretty weak. And as you know, a lot of social psychology research or research generally has been criticized for really not meeting adequate scientific standard because of things like that. Either the questions and the data just simply are not strong enough, representative enough, or inclusive of things that, as you say, depression manifests itself in many ways.
Yeah, it does. One thing I will say that I learned was that we should all not doubt ourselves. If we have a hunch about something, we shouldn't say, and it's so easy to do it. I did it myself for a while there, which mm-hmm. was, I must be wrong. The experts are saying something mm-hmm. different, mm-hmm. but we really should believe in ourselves enough to follow our hunches.
Absolutely. And you know, kudos to you for doing that and following through in the way that you did, but you're exactly right. Everything always needs to be challenged, I believe. That's sort of my mindset. And it's always, actually, interestingly enough, it's always been my mindset, even from a young kid. I didn't realize that growing up until I look back at some of the things that I had written. And I had this sort of optimistic cynicism about it, which is, well, wait a minute, can't you do this a different way? Or is that really right? And that's what, those are the questions you have to ask. And yes, you're right. You had that insight and wisdom to see that. And you followed through on it, which is amazing, because it would be very easy for at a student level to say, well, you know, this guy's the expert in depression and he says this, who am I? Well, you're somebody coming with a different perspective, and that's huge, and that's important. And we've all got to do that, I think, all the time.
I think so. And, you know, most people think of research as very boring. And I did too when I was younger. I thought, how, you know, it's just looking at numbers, it's just looking at things. But in fact, just what you said, challenging what we see and saying, I think there could be something different, that's really what research is. And I think that if people knew that there's kind of an excitement level of solving a problem or getting to sort of solve a puzzle, that's really what research is. Mm-hmm. And so if people like the idea of detective work, or they like the idea of solving problems, then that's the excitement that research is. And so what I did was really just follow a standard researcher's mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. It gets convoluted after a while, but somebody coming into the field, probably like somebody new to any field, doesn't come in with all the preconceived notions and this is how we do it and this is what we've always done. You don't have that, which is a huge advantage, actually. And people who are leaders or managers who don't understand that, don't see it or don't want to see it, are missing out big time. But we know how that works. But that's a great story of how you, as a young student, saw it, didn't trust it initially, but then was convinced enough to say, at least we need to follow through and do more research and prove that you were right. Good for you. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And that's a great story. So that presumably led you to some excitement about research and some excitement about the value that it can bring when it makes changes like that.
Absolutely. You know, I really do love research. It really is something that it's like you're always able to get the gratification of knowing that you went down a path and you can see what the results are. And so that fueled that passion. And, you know, to this day, I still enjoy doing research. A lot of it is more qualitative in nature. But the whole idea of following an idea all the way through has stuck with me. And that's really what has led to each new sort of chapter in my work career. Is it's all sort of in the same vein of following something and saying, that doesn't look right, let me see what it is, which is really a researcher's way of looking at things.
Yes, no, that's, but a creative researcher's way of doing it. I mean, you know, there's research and there's research, right? Yes. So this eventually led to the mentor project. Yeah. I assume this mindset of yours led to that. Tell us about that journey.
So after seeing that, in fact, you know, I worked in the nursing home, and most people think of a nursing home as being, you know, the worst place a person could end up being, that there's sadness and things like that. And I was able to see that people were happy, that people enjoyed they were having enjoyable lives. And the biggest thing that was the most exciting to me was hearing about how people felt about their lives. And, you know, I think that some misconceptions that people have had is that when you get to the end of your life, you're feeling down or depressed or feeling that life isn't worth living. And in fact, I found the opposite to be true. Even people who couldn't do the things that they could once do, they would still say, but I can read, or I can still do some of the things that I get enjoyment and pleasure out of. And I still feel like I'm making a contribution in a way. So I thought to myself, we have a lot to look forward to, and I want to take a deeper look at this. So I started to look at our midlife years, and there's a term that was coined by Eric Erickson, which is generativity. And that's a point in our lives where we have a great desire to give back to the next generation without expecting anything in return. So it's caring for others without looking for a paycheck or without looking for a pat on the back. Right. And so I was looking at that, and I decided, well, let me take a look. There are three different ways that we can involve ourselves in generativity. One is philanthropy, but not everybody can do that. Mm-hmm. That's giving away money. Mm-hmm. The other is volunteering, which is free. And the third is mentorship, and that's mm-hmm. also free. So I thought, let me focus on mentorship and see what is out there. So I went out and I said, I betcha, kind of just like I did with the depression study, I betcha there's something there and that more people mentor than we actually know. Hmm. So I looked at about 45 people from a four-star general all the way down to grandmas. And there was a common thread with all of them. And that was that they all mentored in the same way. They all had the same desire and the same drive, whether it was a grandparent, you know, working with their grandchildren and trying to impart values and mm-hmm. Things that they wanted passed on to the next generation, or if it was someone who was, you know, trying to make a difference in the world for, you know, kidney care or something like that. And interestingly, most of the people that I spoke with who were mentoring, it was not job related. So most people think, oh, mentoring is at the corporate level. So like the four-star general that I interviewed talked about one of the biggest exciting parts of mentoring was with his grandson. Mm-hmm. And that was unexpected for me. Mm-hmm. So what that led me to was I spoke with someone for the book that I was starting, and he said, oh, you have to come out to a hackers convention. And I thought, what am I going to learn there? You know, what will I possibly learn? But I thought, why not? I've never been to one. So it was one of those super secret ones that's in a location that no one knows about. And it's all like the people who have started all of the big tech things that we all know of, you know? And so mm-hmm. it was all of these people that I know nothing about what they do because I'm a psychologist. So I went in and I found that these guys changed the world and how we live it from how we don't have a golden yellow wall phone that has that long, you know, cord that you have to drag if you want privacy into the closet down the hall, you know, we have our phones and our computers in our pockets now. It's because of these guys. And it turns out that they had been mentoring all along by doing what's called lateral mentoring. So for example, Bill Cheswick, the guy who's one of the founders of the firewall, he told me that when he was at Bell Labs and he wanted to solve a problem, he would wheelie himself in his chair over to another guy and say, hey, I've got this problem. You're an expert in this. I'm an expert in this. Can you help me with this? And they would combine their efforts and solve the problem. And that's exactly what Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak did with Apple. Mm-hmm. They both had different kinds of expertise, but without either one of them, it never would have happened. So the power of mentorship is much greater than that hierarchical job-related mentorship mm-hmm. that we all know about. Mm-hmm. Every kind of mentorship that's been sort of lateral has changed our world. Our founding fathers in the United States did that. They all came with different areas of expertise and came together to found the country. Then we had the tech revolution, and that was people from a lot of different backgrounds coming together and not expecting anything in return. They were having a good time. So the Mentor Project was formed because Bill and Bob. Bob is one of the founders of the Mentor Project, and he is the guy who patented how we use credit cards on the internet.
Wow.
And he said to me, we have to get this going. We have to get mentorship out there and get STEM going around the world because it can't be stuck in Silicon Valley. That's where he is. And Bill Cheswick said, I need to get into schools to teach kids before they get jaded and think they can't do math and science. So we formed it, the Mentor Project, with the desire just to, you know, get Bill into some schools, get Bob a couple of kids. Mm-hmm. And then we found that we didn't have to go out and beat the doors down looking for mentors. In fact, just like the theory that we have the desire to give back without expecting anything mm-hmm. in return, mm-hmm. we started out with 10 mentors. And by the end of 2020, we had more than 80 with a wait list.
Wow.
And it's growing. And these are all leaders in their fields. They're people who've done world-changing things. And so what I learned is that, in fact, that little thing in my ear that was saying there's something to that, once it got followed through, we're seeing that, in fact, the mentors are getting more out of it than the mentees, even though we've already had a mentee patent something. We've had a lot of big things come from our mentees, but our mentors are all collaborating on new projects together. People who you would never put together, who have completely different backgrounds, and they're getting so much out of it. And it's a way to feel like, hey, what I do is important, and what I did is important, and my expertise is important. And there's no price that you can put on that. So it's been a real joy to take, you know, some of the developmental ideas that that I was exposed to in my early education and apply that to real life situations and research.
Yeah, no, that's phenomenal. That's great. Yeah, I mean, I think mentorship in general is underrated. You know, as a parent, you know, my son had four or five great mentors that influenced him, without which probably he wouldn't be the man he is today. You know, as parents, that's great, but sometimes you need somebody other than parents, you know, and somebody outside the classroom too, to engage you, you know, in that way. And I did a book on, wrote a book with a great coach from Louisiana called Barrett Murphy, and he wrote a book about six-man football in Louisiana during sort of World War II and just after. And he'd gone and interviewed the players and the coaches and what have you. And the story, really, I mean, it was about football, but the story, actually, the essence of the story was the impact these coaches had on these kids playing. Because, you know, those kids grew up and he interviewed them, you know, towards the end of their lives. And they were saying, if it weren't for Coach so-and-so, I would never have, you know, gone to college, never have done this, never have done that. And it was just very interesting to see how much impact that has on people. Because it does. It just does. We are open to that sort of coaching, whatever you want to call it, influence. We're social animals. That's how we get, and we learn, we copy, we emulate. And yeah, that's phenomenal. It does not surprise me how well that has gone in your process. Yeah, phenomenal. Excellent.
You know, you're probably the only person that says I'm not surprised, because I can't tell you how many people all the way up until we had the 80 who said, that's not a good idea. No one will want to join. No one will want to give back. You know, it's never going to work. And I can't find enough projects for the mentors because they're so engaged. So I'm actually so glad to hear that you said that, because there were a lot of naysayers.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. Probably younger ones. Well, it was interesting. I mentioned Maslow earlier and this addition of this other level from self-actualization to self-transcendence. And that's what they're doing. They're saying, yes. Hey, that I'm what I'm getting. I don't need to be paid for this. I'm getting satisfaction enough out of doing it. And giving is as satisfying, maybe more so, than getting, right?
Yes.
And at a certain point in life, that's one of the values, I think, and one of the things you appreciate perhaps as you get older, because maybe you get to a position where, you know, you're giving things away rather than accumulating them, where you see what is important. And what is important is sharing your skills and knowledge and improving the world. And, you know, that's why it does not surprise me. You're right. I could see it would surprise a lot of people. Say, why they do that for nothing? Why they could make, you know, thousands of dollars an hour? Why would they do that? Yeah, well, you don't understand the mindset.
I try to put it, you know, there's a lot in film that we overlook. We just sort of absorb it, but without taking it in. Mm-hmm. So Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol mm-hmm. Is one of the good examples. I like to go back to the one with Alistair Sim, mm-hmm. who was, it was the 1950s version, but you know, the Scrooge was somebody who is a perfect example of this. And people have watched the movie over and over and over and they don't put it together, but this is exactly how it works in real life. So Scrooge was a self-made man. He had lived in a mansion. He had his big business. He had servants taking care of all of his needs, but he was miserable. And it wasn't until he started giving back without expecting anything from Bob Cratchit or Tiny Tim or his nephew that he started to feel joy. And when I work with clients personally, you know, I also do coaching mm-hmm. with individuals. That's exactly the point that we have to get a lot of people from, is seeing that, you know, sort of hoarding your emotions mm-hmm. and hoarding your, you know, your possessions doesn't bring mm-hmm. you happiness. It's not until you give it away that you feel good.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you may be familiar with this, you know, the studies on happiness around the world have suggested that over about the equivalent of $75,000 a year U.S., money adds nothing to happiness. And while I was interested in that, you may know this, that some Harvard researchers looked at that and said, well, maybe there aren't enough millionaires in there. Maybe it's distorted. Let's look at it. And so they actually did research people who had like $1 million and people who had more than $10 million. And actually they did find differences in happiness with the people who had more money for one reason. They could give it away. They felt yeah. good. That enabled them to help other people. And that's what gave them meaning. And yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, it's something that gets lost in this culture, I think, a lot of time. And of course, I'm sure you're familiar with Bronnie Ware's book, The Five Regrets of the Dying, right?
Yeah.
It isn't how much you got, it's the nature of your relationships, how much you gave, the meaningful things you did in your life. Those are the important things.
Yes, your meaningful connections. You know, the Harvard Longitudinal Study showed that. Laura Carstensen has shown that in her research out of Stanford. Those are all things that have been around for a while and they hold true. And whether they're through philanthropy, mentoring, volunteering, however a person gives away that meaning to others is how we get our fulfillment. I don't want to always say happiness because mm-hmm. that's something that's not, you know, I was speaking with someone who, it doesn't last. I was speaking with someone who's a Buddhist and she was saying that what we really want to go for is Dharma joy, mm-hmm. which is different than happiness. It's mm-hmm. different than the happiness we get when we buy a new handbag or a new pair of shoes.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. it's lasting. And that's mm-hmm. really what we're looking for here and getting.
Yeah, and those studies on happiness really define it as in this way, as sort of eudaimonia, meaning, purpose, not short burst of pleasure. That's not what happiness is. That's fun, but that's not happiness. And I think that's important and probably the greatest source of that meaning and purpose is by helping other people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
In whatever way.
There's something really amazing when I'm able to see a person transform and they see how they're able to take, you know, a lot of people really cling tightly to what they have, you know, mm-hmm. because there's a level of comfort with that also, but it's not as good a feeling as when you give it away. And when I am able to see somebody that's clutching, and then they're releasing it out to others, and it's like an exhale. It's mm-hmm. really like exhaling and feeling like a weight is lifted off your shoulders almost. And I didn't know that when I was younger, and I wouldn't mm-hmm. have expected that when I was younger. It wasn't until mm-hmm. I really hit midlife that I was able to understand it and grasp the depth of that.
It's interesting to see where it comes from. I'm sure cultures differ a lot in that and their understanding of it. I mean, a lot of the Asian cultures, for example, are much more about interdependence rather than independence. Families have that on a continuum too. It's really about the ability to understand empathy, perhaps, as well as compassion, although there's sometimes limits to that. But just the other day, there was a guy, I go on a, jog down my street, and a guy on a bike, and his bike had blown a tire, and I said, oh, well, wait a minute, I'll be home in 5 minutes, and I'll get, I got a pump there, I'll bring it back to you, And just doing something like that is so gratifying,
Absolutely.
It's so gratifying.
Yes, it's true. And I think that, when I'm able to see kids, like I have kids, there's a pull to be as individualistic as you can possibly be and to say, okay, you stay in this silo and try to get up as high as you possibly can. And there's a real pull. I can feel it to saying, oh, you can advance yourself by doing this. And I have to watch to make sure that, we're always being very mindful that that is a short-term gain. And you have to undo a lot of that later if you are really focused on putting blinders on to everyone and everything around you to get success. Helping along the way is actually better for you.
Right. And of course, it's easy to discount, not even think about how interconnected we are.
You're right.
I mean, you could be the richest guy in the world, but if there's nobody, getting food, getting to the store, opening the store, serving the store, you're on your own, buddy. You depend on, we all depend on each other to varying degrees. And that tends to get lost again in the culture, which absolutely is about individuality and independence. But there's a balance. There's got to be a balance there.
Yes, I think that we can balance that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy enough to have, I haven't ever put it into words, but the idea of meaningful advancement, that when you advance, that you're looking to have meaning with each thing. It's not just a box that you're checking.
Right. And as you develop skills or insights, then those shared with other people, that helps everybody, right?
Yes.
So absolutely. I think that mindset is really critical. And when we get divided, I think that gets lost big time, really. But let's not get into politics. So when in this mentor program, who are these mentors mentoring?
Okay, so it's the mentor project, and the mentors are mentoring kids from kindergarten, actually younger than kindergarten, all the way through university. So what we do is we're mentor focused. We know that mentees are going to get something out of a mentor. So we're not really as focused on that. And I don't want to say that, I'm saying that, but I don't want somebody to say, oh, wow, so they don't really care about the kids. We do. Yeah. We obviously do, because that's why we're all trying to give back. But I've found that by focusing on the mentors, which is focusing on their emotional growth and development, which is my area, what we do is we take the person's expertise and say, how do you want to give back? What is it that you want to do? Instead of saying, we have this, list a menu of things to give back with. I mean, that might not resonate with people.
Right.
So the kind of cool thing is that we have a puppeteer who is now in all of the, she's in laundromats and libraries across the country. And she does storytelling and DIY. So it's the very first kind of maker program a kid would have. So they take stuff from around their house and they can build their own puppets to go with the story that she tells. And that's to get kids to see that being a maker, like engineering, those sorts of things, is actually fun. Mm-hmm. And so she's our first, you know, she's working with the youngest kids. We have Bob and Yura Zibas, who's a patent attorney, and she's our vice chair, and Bob is the co-founder, and he's done so many patents. He was Inventor of the Year, actually, for 2020. Mm. So those two came together, and they helped a student patent his idea. So we have that. We do have formal sorts of programs in schools. And during the pandemic, we really pivoted and we brought about 280 or more videos of the mentors giving back their expertise in a video. So we have, you know, Gibor, who is the astrophysicist who discovered brown dwarf mm-hmm. stars, who talked about that in one of his videos. We have, so that's Gibor Basri. We also have the astrophysicist Neil Cummins, who's the author of 21 books. And he has, you know, a cartoon figure of himself mm-hmm. In Japan. And he came out and talked about all the different things, like what if the moon didn't exist and things like that. So we have had Ask Me Anythings. We've had hackathons where kids are now able to present they're able to work with other mentors to get their work published in peer-reviewed journal articles. So high school kids that are doing wow. very high level things because there's been a mentor that just puts in a tiny amount of time, maybe mm-hmm. it's cheering them on, but says, don't do that. That's not gonna help you. Do this. So we work with schools to do that. We're starting up a conference for entrepreneurs that will be for college students. That will allow them to get micro-credentialing and certification, these kinds of things that we're offering now. So we're in classrooms, we do Ask Me Anythings, hackathons, we do puppeteering, we do, sometimes our mentors do one-on-one. So if someone writes mm-hmm. in and they say, I'd really like to talk with somebody, I have a specific, you know, mm-hmm. area that I'd like some guidance on. Our mentors have been with people for almost a year. Mm. One-on-one every week, which is kind of cool to get like cool. a leader. So yeah. those are the things we do.
Amazing. Amazing stuff. So as we come towards the end here, where can people find out about the Mentor Project? Where can they reach you, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. The Mentor Project has a website. We're redoing it. So it's going to be even better in about a week. It's mentorproject.org. So there's a contact form on there. You can reach out and contact us. We're always looking for suggestions from schools and from individuals on what they want to be mentored in. So if you put out there something on our contact form, we will respond and try to accommodate that. We're on all social media as the Mentor Project in on Facebook. We're Mentor Project in Instagram and Twitter and there's another TikTok. We're on LinkedIn as the Mentor Project. So we also have a podcast that our mentors are able to conduct their podcasts. And that's on iTunes and Spotify and Spreaker and all that. So you can reach us in any of those places. And I'm probably the one that will respond to any of them if you reach out to us.
Okay. And if people want to reach out to you individually outside of the Mentor Project?
I have a personal website, deborahheiser.com. You can reach me on LinkedIn. My email is deborahheiser@gmail.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's really awesome to learn about all these great things that you did, and more importantly, perhaps, how you got to do them. So thank you for being a guest. We have to do this again sometime, because probably in a year or so you would have started something new.
We are starting another company. So, but you know, this was a real pleasure. I love what you're doing. I think that it's so good to be able to show the process of how things get done. And as I've listened to your podcast, I just love how you do that. So it was a real privilege and honor to be on your show. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Deborah. Likewise, and we'll see you again soon. Take care.
Take care.